Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 10th of August 2014. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, and Phil from the West End Whingers. We're now going to talk about Medea. This is Euripides' play with a new version by Ben Power, and it stars Helen McCrory as the title character. Nick, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
It's a production by Carrie Cracknell, which is vaguely modern day. It could be in some of the designs. It looks a bit 80s. It's not a period production in that way. And obviously this is not a spoiler to say this is the story of the woman who kills her children as a kind of twisted form of revenge or control over her ex-husband, because it's very much kind of signposted from the start and it's advertised as such. And I thought it was a very powerful production. I saw last year the Headlong one that brought it very much into the present day. And although that was good, I had issues with some of the ways it was modernized, and particularly with the element of Medea being sort of a magical witch kind of character. And I think one thing that this production now at the National and that Helen McCrory in particular does very well is bring that right to the fore from the start and make it a believable thing, because we're always being told that Medea is considered to be or is people talk about her as a witch, and there's a real sort of sense of danger to her and kind of darkness that Helen McCrory brings up. And I think what's interesting to me in this kind of modern setting that the production does is it really kind of brings forth the way that she and her family are kind of treated, as it felt very current, because this is kind of the story of after the Golden Fleece, at which she helped quite horrifically Jason to steal it, and as a consequence of quite what she did to help him, they had to flee very quickly. So where they've landed is that they are very much the foreigners, and I found that quite an interesting thing that the production was kind of bringing to the fore, is that she's someone who's kind of a sort of an immigrant who's treated with suspicion, and she's kind of been left with nothing. And I felt that kind of brought some of the was quite an interesting kind of current update of the story. The other thing it does really bring to the fore, which I've seen a few productions and it's never really been done as clearly, is from the start that this is quite a dangerous woman who will go to extremes because of exactly what she did to her own family years ago to help Jason get the Golden Fleece. So when Jason, who's played by Danny Sapani here, when he does leave her for another woman, that was never going to end well. The only thing I had a few little issues with was I liked the way that the chorus was presented. I thought they were going in a sort of area of them being very much in her own head. And then right at the end, they kept a scene where Jason speaks to them directly. And I kind of wished that their lines had been given to someone else at that point, because it kind of made them solid and put a lot of questions as to why these women were in this house with her, and B, why they wouldn't do anything to stop what she does. But overall, I mean, it's the way the chorus is used in terms of music, which is by Goldfrapp, and sort of the dance kind of jerky motions at it. There is kind of a generally with Helen McCrory's performance, which is just outstanding, there is this feel of a sort of horror movie kind of lurking in the background, and the design kind of beautifully brings this danger in. So it's a modern Medea, but it's not in any way kind of a domestic one. It's quite a spooky and powerful one, and I think one of the better productions of the play I've seen.
Gareth, what did you think of it?
Yes, I mean, I've seen quite a few Medeas, and every time I see it, I keep having to remind myself it's 2,500 years old. And for me, this is probably amongst the most credible and chilling sort of versions of the play, really. And Ben Power does take a lot less liberties with the play than Mike Bartlett did in the 2012 adaptation that Nick mentioned, where he, I thought, maybe just took a few too many. This Carrie Cracknell production for me, though, is really excellent. And I like so many things about it, really. I've always thought Helen McCrory was made for either Lady Macbeth or this, or, you know, similar roles, really. And she certainly does invest an awful lot into this. I was sitting right in the front row, and sometimes that isn't a good thing. But on this occasion, I actually really liked being able to sort of see her acting up close. And she just invested so much emotionality into the role. You know, she was often visibly shaking, her eyes were welling up, her nose was running, the tears were flowing. I just thought it was a stunning performance. And that's not to take anything away from the others. I mean, Danny Sapani, for me, was very commanding Jason. And I think, you know, more restrained and therefore able to sort of make the switch from anger to forgiveness more believable. And there's just luxury casting, really. I mean, you've got people like Dominic Rowan and Martin Turner as the two kings. And another scene I really, really thought was effective was when Creusa, who's Jason's new wife, puts on the cloak that is poisoned that that Medea gives her. She does a kind of dance of death, which I thought was just extraordinary, really. And as Nick said, the Goldfrapp musical, well, the soundtrack, Goldfrapp soundtrack, I think, adds a lot to this piece. So I just thought it was a riveting 90 minutes. I thought it was spot on the Olivier stage. They really used the Olivier stage well. And of course, you know, a fine actress giving what is undoubtedly going to be, I think, a kind of career-defining performance. So I unmissable for me.
We probably should also mention Michaela Cole, who plays the nurse, and Toby Wharton, who, a very small part for Toby Wharton. I saw him in a play that he wrote, Fog, a couple of years ago, and he was very impressive. I, of course, have actually seen Helen McCrory playing Lady Macbeth. I think it's something she should revisit. It was certainly seeing it in 1995 or something at the Tricycle, very brief, you know, very quick performance, all done without an interval. But that Macbeth, and she was extremely good, and it really switched me on to seeing her. I'd seen her a few times in, you know, RSC things before that, but it really made her a name that was firmly, you know, embedded in my head. She is, of course, very, very impressive in this. I had a slight problem with the choreography. I can't complain about it because it was good. Although I did think of, I think it's Merce Cunningham, who late in his career helped develop a piece of software which would imitate the movements of the human body, and he was able to get his dancers to go into all sorts of weird poses, and I was slightly reminded of that here. This is Lucy Guerin's choreography, but it was, I mean, it's very modern, but it also, I think, it wasn't so much that I thought the choreography didn't work. It did work, but it was very much choreography in very capital letters, and it was slightly off-putting. It was slightly at variance with the play, or stood out a bit too much in the way that the music felt that it went with the play, but the choreography sort of seemed to be fighting it a little bit, and I had a slight problem with that. But other than that, yes, this is a good one. This is a good performance.
I'm glad you mentioned Michaela Cole, actually, because I thought she delivered the prologue and the epilogue absolutely superbly in complete silence. The soundtrack was not playing and the audience were absolutely still, and I thought that was great, both the prologue and the epilogue. She did that really well.
We're now going to talk about Shakespeare in Love at the Noel Coward Theatre. This is an adaptation by Lee Hall of Tom Stoppard's film of the same name, which possibly due to an extremely good Oscar campaign by the Weinstein brothers, ran away with practically all the Oscars when it came out. Phil, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, I was never a huge fan of the film. I liked it enough. I was sort of staggered, really, that it got 7 Oscars, including Judi Dench, which I think she was on screen for 8 minutes or something. Although, you know, as good as she was, I think it was basically because they didn't give her one for Mrs. Brown, which is fair enough. But I feel, having seen the reviews for this, now that it's come out, a bit the same sort of feeling. I'm astonished that people have sort of fallen in love with it so much. I mean, some of them are sort of practically swooning. In fact, I've seen that in one of the reviews. It's on the posters now. And Paul Taylor said, it makes you grateful to be alive. Well, I was grateful when it was over. I mean, to be fair, I did see an early preview, and I assume it's changed a lot. And I know it's been trimmed, but it was nearly 3 hours from when I saw it. But having said that, a friend of mine I was talking to about it the other night, who saw the last preview, felt that it dragged on, particularly at the end, and agreed with most of the points I made. One that I thought sometimes to look at, it was actually quite scrappy. The cast is huge. I mean, it's a cast of 28, so it's very extravagant. It's got sort of the production values of a big scale musical. So it's going to have to really, I would have thought, play to near capacity to break even. I mean, it's got Disney and Sonia Friedman behind it, so I think, you know, they'll be able to keep it running. It's not going to be like the Full Monty, which got great reviews and, you know, was off within a few weeks. But I think that's probably for other reasons. I thought it really kicked off really well with the young Shakespeare who's suffering from writer's block. And I thought Tom Bateman was very good as Shakespeare. He had good stage charisma, he always does. And Lucy Briggs Owen, have I got her name right? Yeah, as the sort of Viola de Lesseps, who is a sort of wannabe actress who drags up as a man to basically to be allowed to perform because women weren't allowed on the stage in those days. I thought both of them, they had great charisma together. Everything about it really should have been terrific. But I found a lot of the scenes when there was a lot of people on, I just didn't know where to focus on. And the person I saw who saw the last preview felt the same. And reading a few of the less sort of praising reviews, you can see there's a few that felt exactly the same. I mean, even Libby Purvis gave this 3 stars and said it was, I think it wasn't funny enough or clever enough or touching enough. And I'm pretty much with her. The ending just goes on and on and on. We had, it seemed like the whole of the Romeo and Juliet death scene, which I thought was unnecessary, and I believe that's still in it. And although some of the gags are terrific, I remember the best ones from the film. I mean, the boat scene with the sort of the taxi, the water taxi, is very good, and there's a very neat bit of staging with the way that the sound of the water is done. Very nice touches like that. And I thought the sort of the X Factor style audition scene was very funny, although I thought getting jokes about the stuttering actor who was auditioning was just lame and should have been cut. Maybe it has been, I don't know. And then there's the sort of the Ethel, the pirate's daughter gag, which is repeated endlessly, and it's really not that funny in the first place. And the dog gags, I just thought were fairly hopeless. I didn't understand why. It hadn't been, a lot of this had been really tidied up and cut. But again, as I say, it may have been since I saw it.
Yeah, I saw it, well, fairly recently.
You've seen it since the opening?
Yeah, I think so. And it hadn't been cut. I don't think it has been cut. It was fairly long once I saw it. Nick, yeah. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I saw the final preview and it was still nearly 3 hours. And there was still, basically everything that Phil mentioned that was in there was still in there. Including massive chunks of Romeo and Juliet, which, I mean, it's far from my favourite Shakespeare play to start with, and certainly chucking that particular scene in out of context, it does absolutely no favours either to the play or to, you know, Romeo and Juliet itself. Nothing really comes out of that very well from doing that. So I'm baffled as to why there's this like solid 10 minutes or so of Romeo and Juliet in there. And I don't know whether there was kind of this desperation maybe they thought the relationship wasn't, you know, dramatic enough and they needed to have them pretend to die on stage as well. Yeah, I don't know whether I don't know if I disliked it quite as much as that. I just kind of found it a bit pointless. I mean, I did quite like the film and there's parts of it that I remember very clearly. And actually, there is a particular kind of one-line gag in the film that I really remember, which is to do with the identity of a young child. And that's kind of expanded in this, but it's kind of a good example of where the overall sort of expansion of the script doesn't really work. I mean, because this was a very short scene that ends with a punchline. And now that's kind of drawn out into a character who runs for the entire show, which is amusingly enough, but then the punchline is still kept for the end. And the punchline is who this person is. And I think, I mean, it runs across the interval. So, I mean, even if people didn't remember the joke from the film, they would have been able to check their programs and see exactly who this was. So it's quite a bizarre way to drag out what was one of the better gags in the film and kind of kill it completely. And that's kind of how I feel about the whole thing. I did. It was a bit deja vu because, you know, 6 months earlier I was in the same theatre watching the Full Monty, and I came out of both of them thinking, well, I could have just seen the film again. I was hoping, kind of, with sort of the Cheap by Jowl creative team behind it, that there was some kind of really big kind of conceit that was going to be applied to it, that was really going to make it justified to bring it to the stage for some reason other than just it looks like a safe money earner. But I didn't really see that in the, you know, the design's clever enough and the staging's clever enough, but it's, you know, that's about it. It's never kind of blown me away. Where I would disagree is with Tom Bateman. I have never found him charismatic, and I didn't find him charismatic here. I mean, actually, to the point where, and I mean, it's never a good sign if you're watching something and already mentally composing your review. But when I was doing that, I found that I'd gone a very long way without actually considering the person who was on stage almost permanently. You know, you kind of, for me, you kind of look at anybody but him, which is not a great sign for a leading man. And maybe, you know, maybe he's doing something in the audition room that's, you know, maybe if I ever see him in a small space, I'll see what, you know, what people are seeing in him. But so far, I've only ever seen him in sort of West End venues. And I've never really seen what the draw is. But Lucy Briggs-Owen, I would say, is absolutely fantastic. She's always someone I've liked. She's always someone I've found kind of quirky and charming. And she does that here as well. But you know, if it wasn't for the fact that the sort of story is that she's already fallen in love before meeting Shakespeare because she's fallen in love with his writing, I wouldn't have seen any reason for the two of them to be a couple. Yeah, I mean, that's basically, I mean, I went with someone who hadn't seen the film and he absolutely loved it. And I think that might be the key to it, really. I think if you know the film, and it was a long time since I saw the film, but I did remember it fairly well. And I do think, you know, there are, I should, before I finish, mention that there are some really good names in the supporting cast as well, and they don't disappoint. I mean, Paul Chahidi is in it. He plays the sort of debt-ridden producer who's trying to stage this show. And then you've got Ferdy Roberts is playing sort of the moneylender who starts out kind of as sort of the villain of the piece and ends up becoming kind of a really geeky theatre fan who's really into getting the production to work. And there's Anna Carteret is playing the cameo role that was Judi Dench's as the Queen. And David Oakes is Marlowe, who's, again, that's another part that's been expanded a bit. And he's more of a sort of sidekick to Shakespeare. One thing that actually they do, I hadn't thought of it this way, but it is a kind of another sort of slightly sinister way to look at it, is there's a lot more jokes in this about other people writing, other people coming up with Shakespeare's lines, which he then uses, whether that's meant to be sort of a little commentary on the authorship question, I don't know. But it is kind of a running joke that's pretty much an addition to this, I think. And it is like all the jokes really drawn out and milked.
I did quite enjoy all the authorship questions, but it was seen that he was supposed to put all the final touches to it. I did wonder, because I hadn't actually seen the film. I've seen bits of the film, and I've seen parts of the film, but I've never seen the whole thing all the way through. I can't actually think why. So I came at this not entirely fresh and not entirely without seeing it, because, you know, I knew the story and everything. It was an interesting experience because I found myself thinking of Blackadder the Second, or Blackadder II, which is the one which was set in the Elizabethan period, and of course made an awful lot of jokes like that, and was so much more knowledgeable about it. I mean, they were very, you know, they're a couple of very smart guys, Richard Curtis and Ben Elton, who wrote the series, and they really know, you know, they know their stuff, and they know all the jokes that they can make, and they do it an awful lot better than, well, I don't know if it is Lee Hall here or Tom Stoppard's thing. I mean, normally you'd expect a lot more knowledge in Tom Stoppard, but if Lee Hall's been expanding on it, he perhaps doesn't quite have the feeling for it that they did in Blackadder. And it was a rather unfortunate when you're comparing Lucy Briggs-Owen with
Gabriel Glaister's character of Bob, who does pretty much what she does, and you shouldn't really be thinking about that when she's performing, because it's not, you know, it's not really, well, I don't know if it's not really fair on her, but it's not really good to be thinking of something else while you're watching a performance. So it did trouble me that slightly. I mean, I found it entertaining enough, but yeah, it does feel like something, you know, out to be a crowd pleaser rather than to be of massive quality. I think it's there to charm everybody, and charm everybody who seems to have remembered the film but hasn't seen it, but haven't seen it recently, or like the film a lot. I mean, that you certainly got that feel from Anna Carteret. I mean, she could do much more with a role like that, but it is doing sort of, because Judi Dench got the Oscar, they sort of bring out the part, and in fact she doesn't take the curtain call immediately. She sort of processes on to take it at some point. So it's a rather odd thing like that. It's good, but I'm not going to I wouldn't rave about it, I don't think, and it has its problems.
I would have expanded the part of Queen Elizabeth, because actually, you know, some of her bits were, I thought, some of the best bits in the play, and she's kept sort of quite at a distance, either on the one of the balconies or towards the back of the stage, which I sort of wanted her to come into it more, and it felt that she's, perhaps I was deliberate, very much an outsider. But I've generally felt it was laboured, and I do wonder with the sort of the theatrical in-jokes, if that's going to be enough to get the kind of numbers of people in to make this a long runner, which I assume they're hoping for, because, you know, you sort of, I know they're the well-known Shakespeare quotes, but will a lot of theatre goers get those? And I think the joke that you're talking about, Nick, the one that's dragged out about the identity of this particular person, which I remember from the film, and it was a big howling joke, but it's very much one of those where you can feel quite smug in getting it.
Well, the reason that I remember that joke so much from the film is that I saw it in a packed cinema, and I remember only me and one other person laughing. Actually, I think it got more laughs this time, but I think you can tell the laughs when people are kind of deliberately laughing, so everybody knows they've got the joke. And I think it's more that sort of thing, because, like I say, I mean, they kind of make it really hard on themselves for that joke to work, because it's dragged out throughout the entire length of the show, and, you know, right up past the interval. Like I say, it is a question of who he's playing, and that is listed everywhere. You know, there'll be a picture of him in the programme saying this is who he's playing.
Yeah, and if you remember the joke from the film, it's kind of killed it already, because it started, I thought, well, I know the joke is coming, but I was thinking, when is the joke going to come?
Yeah.
I did like the ferryman scene. I think that, because that's one of the bits I remember most from the thing, and I thought that was well done. I wanted sort of more of that, really. I think, and that's very much Stoppard, as far as I remember, because that's in the film. Same with the
I saw somewhere Lee Hall saying that it's only kind of 10% of it is his of what's written, so it's like 90% of it is directly from the film, and I think that's the thing, isn't it? There's kind of a bit too much that's so identical that there's not really much point, and then what little there is that's new isn't actually that good, doesn't really add anything.
We're now going to talk about The Streetcar Named Desire at the Young Vic. This is the latest production by Benedict Andrews of Tennessee Williams' play, and it stars Gillian Anderson, Vanessa Kirby and Ben Foster in the main roles of Blanche, Stella and Stanley. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
It's actually quite a modern interpretation, really, of Tennessee Williams. What Benedict Andrews and his designer, Magda Willey, have done is they've created this apartment which revolves, and the audience are all around it, but there's only sort of four rows of audience. So you really are kind of on top of it, and it really does seem as if you're peering into the apartment. I think that's particularly good at sort of showing the claustrophobia of where they're living, but it's not so good at showing the community outside, because there's also, you know, they're in a kind of oppressive part of a city, New Orleans, I think. So it's not so good at showing that, but it's particularly good at showing the oppression in the apartment. And of course, everybody gets to sort of, you know, this continual moving thing. It really is quite sort of draws you into the play, and everybody gets to see things from different angles. So I thought that was very, very good indeed. I don't think they've obsessed with the play. I mean, it's longer than a streetcar normally is, so I guess that must be stage business, because I don't think they've sort of added any dialogue into it. Or it could be just there's a disease in the cut at the moment where you have to do everything for 3.5 hours long, because the Crucible across the road at the Old Vic is longer than the play's ever been as well. But I think it's a very good interpretation of Streetcar. I enjoyed it very much, and I think it's probably not just the staging, but it does have three excellent lead performances. I mean, Gillian Anderson is a superb Blanche. There's no question about that. And I've seen quite a few Blanches, including Glenn Close and Jessica Lange and Rachel Weisz. And I think she really does make the role her own. But Ben Foster, gives a kind of even less sympathetic interpretation of Stanley than one's used to seeing, and a very kind of physical, very kind of edgy, angry kind of role. And I thought he was excellent. And indeed, Vanessa Kirby as Stella. She's torn between husband and sister. And I think that kind of comes over very clearly. I think what the production emphasizes more than I've seen it before, really, is the culture clash. Obviously it's there, but somehow it really just hits you in the face this time, the kind of culture clash between Blanche and Blanche's and Stella's past in reality, and this kind of new world that Stella's now in, having married Ben. So I thought it was a very gripping production. It frankly didn't feel its length. It was about 3 hours 20, I think, when I saw it, and it didn't feel its length. I found the whole thing very gripping, and I think it was another great evening at the Young Vic, really. And I think it kind of belongs in the Young Vic. It's sort of, that kind of fresh look at things, it seems to me, is something that Young Vic has started to do very well, just recently with A View from a Bridge, and indeed with other things. I didn't see his Three Sisters there last year, but I'm told that was also something very special as well. So I would thoroughly recommend it. It's probably impossible to get a ticket now anyway. And even though people are clearly, Gillian Anderson is clearly a draw, it isn't a star vehicle. And I think that's a great thing. I think all of the cast are very good. In addition to the ones I mentioned, there's obviously the bit parts that are very well, very well cast as well. So a play I adore, a playwright that I really, really like, and a production and interpretation that I thoroughly enjoyed.
Nick, what did you think about it?
I agree. I think it's a very good production. It is one of these things that it was so hard to get tickets in the first place, and it's so sold out that you want to go, yeah, go see it, but it's not really. If you don't have tickets, you probably can't. I think they're doing the sort of lottery style ticket returns on the day, so queuing very early won't necessarily help. But yeah, it is a very interesting look at it. I think what I find interesting is when you take, and it's the same thing that I felt with the Three Sisters, the Chekhov a couple of years ago, is that there are certain writers who you're quite used to seeing taken out of the context. There's nobody finds it strange if you don't set a Shakespeare in Elizabethan or Jacobean London, but Chekhov and now Tennessee Williams, it's very unusual to see them outside of the very precise setting that they were originally given. And it is quite fascinating to see how they survive in that. I actually saw last year when Central Theatre did Streetcar, and the additional thing that they kind of took out of it was the accents, because they all did it in their own accents, which makes it kind of interesting in terms of it makes you understand certain things about the language, which was quite fascinating. Here, what's happening, it's been modernized. It is kind of this sort of white trash modern day version of New Orleans that they're kind of stuck in. And I think really what's happening here is, I think it's right to say that you don't get much of the outside community, because I think this is, especially with the sort of constant revolve, I think what's going on is that we're very much inside Blanche's head, and it feels like a psychological thriller at times. It feels quite frightening at other times, and it's very well put together, and it's nothing against the rest of the cast, as Gareth so said, they're very good, and Vanessa Kirby's very good, and Corey Johnson, who plays the character of Mitch, who's a potential suitor for Blanche, is good. But this really is more than productions I've seen before. This it is absolutely about the first two, about Blanche and Stanley. And to me, the first act before the interval is very much all about Stanley and the the second act is much more Blanche's. I don't know whether I would say that he's a less sympathetic Stanley. I mean, he's certainly not sympathetic, but then the character isn't. But I think something that that feels very clear in this production, it's funny how, you know, you can say the exact same words in different productions and other ones all stand out. And I think it's very apparent here because Ben Foster's kind of covered in tattoos and he's also wearing his dog tags very visibly. I think you never forget that this is a former soldier. And I feel like the production really suggests there's sort of a post-traumatic stress thing going on with him as to what kind of kicks off some of his behavior. And I think there's also a fascinating moment, the way it's played, where he overhears Blanche, who's kind of really taken against him, and she's describing him as sort of an evolutionary throwback. And he just sort of stands there and listens and then, you know, pretends to be coming in. And you can really see where that's kind of a turning point in the story, where there's been this clash between the two of them. But from then, it's kind of, it's this man who's been told he's barely human, and from then on he's out to get her, he's out to take her down. So there's kind of a sort of twisted sort of triumph to the second act, and that's the one where really Gillian Anderson gets to get her teeth into the play more. Like I say, this does feel like it's going on partly inside her head, like we're being taken into exactly what kind of, as it's quite interesting that a revolve is kind of constantly spinning, but it's also the speeds change, and as things get more desperate, the direction will suddenly change as well. And I think it all contributes to this feeling of sort of where we are and where we're not quite in a literal interpretation, that we are kind of entering into how she sees the world and where, what sort of world she's living in inside her head. So I think it does live up to, I mean, the trouble with productions that are kind of so hard to get tickets for is that they've got a lot to live up to. This one fortunately does. It's probably not going to end up being the most memorable production this year, simply because at the Young Vic, I mean, simply because A View from the Bridge happened. But it's still an absolutely fascinating look at, and a very, it feels like it's a very specific take on the play, which is still a very good production overall. You absolutely get what the play is saying, but it's also really got a lot of its own ideas about the story it's telling.
I like this production. I did have a few problems. I didn't quite like it as much as I enjoyed the Secret Theatre version of the Lyric Hammersmith. It was, I mean, it's much more, it's much closer to the play, but somehow the modernising didn't work because they didn't play with it enough, I thought. The modernising was just modern, you know, just put in a modern context for the sake of a modern context. It didn't engage the play at all. It didn't attempt to play with the play at all. It didn't, you know, it didn't really do anything extra. It just sort of distracted you slightly because you became more aware of some of the archaic use of language. And I did have a slight problem with that. Also, the thing that came across when I saw the Secret Theatre version of it at the Lyric Hammersmith was how much I almost liked Stanley in that production. You just got that it's something that Stella says, that she says that that Stanley is going places. And in the Secret Theatre version, I really got that this Stanley, however brutish and sort of Neanderthal he is, he was going somewhere. He had cunning, he was smart, you know, and he had smarts that he could use. I mean, might not be book smarts, but he certainly understood things. And when he starts talking about, you know, the Napoleonic Code, you get the feeling he's actually read it. You certainly got that in the Secret Theatre version. In this version, Stanley's much too much of a brute for me. I mean, he's too much of a brute, too much of a drunk. And in many ways, that is how it is written. But I wanted a slightly more nuanced. I wanted that intelligence, that brain, that thing that says, you know, when Stella says he's going somewhere, that I would be convinced that he was going somewhere. And I didn't get that from this, unfortunately. But I mean, that's only a quibble out of a couple of quibbles out of a show that was really well put together and really well done, I think. Gillian Anderson, again, the only problem with Gillian Anderson, perhaps, is that she was easily the best-looking person on stage, and I'm sorry, you know, you don't quite believe that she's sort of a blown Southern rose. She's very much still got everything she needs to have, I thought. And there's also that slight idea of her saying that Stella has put on weight, and you're a little bit worried about just how anorexic Stella was before she'd put on weight, because Vanessa Kirby is a very slim woman. But I mean, these are minor quibbles. It is a very good show, and it's, you know, second really great play I think this year at the Young Vic. You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.